Hello, everyone. Welcome to Setter Talk. I am your host, Kyle Warren. This podcast is sponsored by Embark Vet and Dr. Tim's Pet Food. Embark Vet is a DNA testing company focused on helping breeders and purebred dog enthusiasts understand and improve the genetic health of their dogs. Embark's DNA test provides a comprehensive assessment of your dog's genetic health, genetic diversity, and physical traits. Embark's DNA testing process was created in partnership with Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine, and test results are accepted by OFA and other leading canine health organizations. To learn more, visit embarkvet.com/breeders. And by Dr. Tim's Pet Food, created by veterinarian and accomplished musher Dr. Tim Hunt. Dog food formulas promoting stamina, endurance, and performance through proper nutrition. Dr. Tim's has been fueling champions for many years in the Iditarod, the field trial circuit, and hardworking hunting dogs all across North America. To learn more about the trusted source of nutrition for the canine athlete, visit drtims.com. Okay, so... All right. Well, Mike, thanks for coming on the show. It's been a while since I've had a Setter Talk episode, kind of getting into my recording season now, as I'm anxiously waiting for puppies and some girls to come into heat. So we had talked last week that inspired this conversation, but why don't you give everybody just a quick introduction of yourself, who you are, where you're from, what you do, what kind of dogs you have, and then we'll jump into a bunch of different topics.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks, Kyle, for having me. My name is Mike Ammon. I'm a forester in northern Wisconsin. I'm a county forester. I've been working with Bayfield County for 20 years. Originally from the southern part of the state, I grew up hunting and fishing. As I moved up north and became a forester, I got really keyed into rough grouse since I'd seen him at work and didn't have a dog. My wife, now wife, had a bird dog. And so when I met her, I started getting into serious grouse hunting. And recently, we'll talk about this. I had Weimaraners, great, I had good experiences, but I was looking for more of a specialist and got keyed into your dogs. And I got a three-year-old PRL and very excited about it. But I'm involved in land management. And as part of land management, there's use on the forest, and so we're kind of assessing forest, the management, and the use. But it's I love northern Wisconsin, and I'm an avid grouse hunter.
Cool, awesome. Well, obviously, a lot of serious grouse hunters might know the answer to this question, but just from a person that's on the ground, involved in forestry on a government level, I know your wife Amy is also involved in forestry, correct?
Actually, she's a soil scientist for the Ottawa National Forest. So she's involved in natural resources and is gotcha. Supports timber management as part of her job and assessing impacts on the soils. So we have a lot, and it's kind of nice. We both work in natural resources.
Yeah, cool. So something that we don't really see much in Michigan as far as public hunting land is county land. The county land here pretty much, to my understanding, was, you know, many, many years ago given to school systems. So various school systems across Michigan do have some ownership in land that some of these school systems had given back to the state. Others manage them, and they do like various student land management exercises there, and it's pretty cool to see our county that I live in does have that program, and they are involved with the students on the land. In Wisconsin, so you have county, state, and federal land that is I won't say all managed, but generally speaking, my experiences in Wisconsin is a lot of it is managed well. On my side of the state in Wisconsin, I don't quite get over quite as far as you, but you know, my experience is some of the most beautifully manicured grouse woods is Wisconsin Wisconsin County Forest. They really seem to like go the extra mile, you know, just in terms of it being like super clean. You know, you can, it's in Michigan, you can tell like when you drive by, the state of Michigan does a really good job also of how they manage their land. And, you know, you can tell when you drive by a state cut versus when you drive by a commercial forest cut, you know, pretty quickly. And I found that to be the same there. Anything that, you know, kind of jumps out at you as far as the different levels of management, depending upon which level of government we're talking about with Wisconsin land?
Yeah, no, that's good. I should kind of explain some of those differences in the Minnesota's got county forest, Wisconsin's got county forest, Michigan, Gogebic County has a small county forest. And just as you explained, some of the long history of these tax delinquent lands and what were we going to do with them. And so county forest system is the largest public landowner in Wisconsin at 2.3 million acres in 30 or 31 counties. And we've been around since the late 20s. And so the mandate was, well, what were we going to do with these lands that were cut over, tax delinquent? There was no infrastructure. There was no support. And then the state programs kind of got started. We need to reforest these acres, rehabilitate these acres. And then the National Forest in the early 1900s had the Weeks Act and some of these programs to purchase these tax delinquents and assist these counties and states with forestry. And that's how the National Forest really got started east of the Mississippi. So the goal of these, the county forest system is really to provide local jobs, local revenue, and local products. And that was, you know, sustainable forestry. Our biggest asset are these forests. And as we manage these as a long-term landowner, I feel, and with the emphasis on timber production and public use, trails, hiking, all that stuff, we're really into ski trails, bike trails, all these other uses that are growing, campgrounds. But the forest products industry and our support of that is really a big part of the county forest system. And so, you know, at the local level and the local mission statement, that's what we do at the county forest system, overseen by the county government, smaller, 10% of our revenues go back to the townships and the local tax revenue loss. We try and make up for that with our revenue, which is a big income for these rural counties, is timber revenue into the county coffers to pay for the county programs. And it's been a success story. And as part of that success story is, you know, a professional staff that is looking at this with, you know, long-term sustainability and then wildlife benefits. You know, a lot of our wildlife kind of is dependent on multi-age forests. And, you know, as part of our job is to sort of assess, you know, what are we doing for wildlife benefits? What are we doing for timber production, different species? Are we successfully regenerating those? So at the state level, they answer to all of the state. And so there's going to be more people interested in what state lands are going to do. So they, you know, their mission is maybe not quite as clear cut as the local level, and the National Forest answers to everybody. And so wilderness areas, non-motorized areas, semi-primitive areas, that's a national conversation reflected locally on these lands. So I think when folks step onto a national forest and be like, why aren't they cutting this aspen? You know, their stakeholders are everybody. And so, you know, that just, you know, there's, which I think is good. You know, there's the Park Service in Bayfield County. We have the Apostle Islands. They have their set asides in the National Forest, at least on the western side. Rye work is fairly aggressive on the early successional species they have. So yes, every different level of government has kind of got more people looking at it and more public input and different objectives. And the county forest system is really geared towards local revenue, local products, local jobs. And so that's why I think, you know, with the professional staff and forestry and oversight, you know, private timberlands, they're a huge contributor to the market and to mills. And a lot of that is done really well. But I think with a lot of these industry lands are just the shorter term landowner revenue profit, which that's their business model. That's what they're going to do. And I think at least at the county forest, we're going to own this in perpetuity. So we need to, you know, what am I doing in 10 years? How is this harvest looking? We need to ensure long-term sustainability. We are going to be the long-term landowner. So I think that's what's really nice about working forest lands at the county level is we're equipped with the resources and we're not driven necessarily by what's the revenue going to be in the next quarter. We're driven by what is a sustainable harvest of the property we have how many acres of aspen, how many acres of northern hardwood, what's the silvicultural rotation of these species, and how do we manage those? And that's what's driving our harvest rate.
That's awesome. So when as far as like you know, the public landowners, county, state, federal, like we're talking in Wisconsin, is there I mean, it sounds like it's a very successful, long going, strong program and formula that you guys have. Has there been any like selling of county land, or, you know, again, the one thing I'm not making any more of is land. So it's always depending on all across the whole country, right? It's always a juggling act, you know, whether it's finances, special interests, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just curious with the state that you're in and help manage, you know, what's that landscape look like in terms of, you know, on a county and state level with, you know, playing moving chess pieces with land?
Excellent question. We talk about this all the time. They're not making any more land. And so first off, it's really hard to sell county forests. We are directly tied to a lot of DNR policy, which is a good thing. It sort of brought us into the profession. When we started, we didn't have professional staff. We still rely on the Wisconsin DNR to do a fair amount of management in support of our efforts. And so there's a really good relationship between the county and the DNR, Wisconsin DNR, Natural Division of Forestry. And as part of that, there's these safeguards to not have county boards say, hey, we got some lakefront property. We're short on revenue. Let's sell some lakefront property. And that's a real concern, because tax revenue in these rural counties, you know, jobs, bringing people, tourism, how much public land is enough public land? Do we need more? And so at the county board level, the nice thing about being nimble and small is you can get some things done, but you can also make rash decisions based on the staff that's there, that's elected. Say, we're gonna sell some land. This is worth a lot of money. Let's do it. And so I think there's definitely some backstops that the DNR has at higher and better use. We do land trades, and we sell it off occasionally, but very rarely, very unique. And if anything, in Bayfield County, we've been very progressive in the form of actually acquiring quite a bit of land, because the timber industry is kind of, well, the timber investment management organizations, they're kind of big real estate companies. They sell their land every 5 to 10 years, and they kind of chip away off at the edges. And over time, that pot of accessible, open to hunting land is getting smaller and smaller. And so Bayfield County still has some of these large industrial timber company lands, paper company, historic paper company lands within our blocking that have become available. And the county board really makes a decision is, yes, we want to pursue acquiring those lands. So we've used some state resources, some federal grants to actually shore up some inholdings, which is nice, because a lot of these are historic working timber lands. And if they get broken into a 40 here, a 20 here, you know, in terms of the landscape benefit of working forests and the wildlife and access, but we're not going outside of our blocking to go grab other properties. But Bayfield County has added probably 10,000 acres in the last 10 years, and we won't do it forever. There's only so much we're looking at. And some counties do not do that at all, just because of the county board or just because of the lack of that opportunity. But Bayfield County has been good in acquiring, because these are unique opportunities to pick these lands up and hold them in the public trust through good management. So definitely it's a real asset to Bayfield County to do that. But yes, the National Forest and the state and the county, we're holding on to what we have, but it's a timely conversation. There's a lot of pressure to talk about rural tax base, how much land is enough land, and how do we, as people want to move up north, where do we live? A lot of it's public land. Some people see it as an asset. Some people see it as a drag on the economy. So it's definitely something that's talked about a lot in Wisconsin politics, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that's that's all really interesting. So let's jump over to you and your upland experiences a little bit more. I know, you know, we connected whatever it is now, 4, maybe even 5 years ago. when you started to think about another dog. And, you know, I know while you're passionate about the rough grouse and you live in rough grouse country, you're also a man with Western dreams. And, you know, you certainly the last few years, it seems like you've made it a point to spend, you know, more time out there and explore a little bit more. Why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, just where you're hunting. You hunt a very good number of days. And again, you live in grouse country. So certainly when you're not traveling out west, grab a hunt during the week after work, you know, and do the weekend warrior thing too. But I know you spent quite a bit of time out west in a few different places. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. That's fairly new for me to get into Western hunting. I started here in Bayfield County grouse hunting. Like, I'm grouse hunting every day. And I did. I mean, I literally after work, fortunate to be able to just pretty much hunt every day. And I did. And it's addicting when you start have that routine of hunting. And I had some friends. I never really thought about, oh, I'm going to hunt out west. Why would I go out west? I got rough grouse. I'm just going to hunt rough grouse. And then a buddy of mine, Ted Summer, was doing some hunting out west for sharptails and prairie chickens. And he was describing it to me. And the more he described it to me, I'm like, okay, let me get this straight. It's early September. The woods are hot, humid, and green. And visibility is poor. And you're walking basically in tennis shoes across the prairie on birds that are holding tight, flushing, you know, it's a good dog work. And you do that for 6, 7, 8 days. Huh. And you come back and then you grouse on after. Well, maybe I should think about this. And so then I went out west with Ted soon thereafter, and it was really nice. Oh, wide open. Look at the dog work. Look at him work the open landscape. Oh, he's on scent. All these things you don't necessarily see in the rough grouse woods. You're just hoping the dog finds the bird out there, and you walk up and find him and be like, oh, is the bird here or not? But so I was really drawn to that landscape and seeing the dogs work and just getting good open shots, and just, it was so much different. And I'd come back to the grouse woods in the middle of September and walk back in the woods and be like, ah, this is hard. I'm tripping and falling. And so I think it's just a good time of year to kind of go out west, get my fix out there, and then come back and grouse hunt. And so the more I'm doing that, the more I'm like, well, late September, early October, you know, it's still pretty early here. Maybe I'll make another trip out west. So, and then my wife, she doesn't hunt, but she really likes to see the dogs work, and just, she likes to travel. We do a lot of traveling, mostly out west. In August, we do 2-week trips. So we love it out west traveling. And so her and I, the last couple of years, have actually just, I go with a group of guys for a week, and then I'll go back with her for another week. And it's just her and I sleep in the back of our truck with the dog, just bumming around. And this year we went back to, we went to Wyoming, which I've never hunted. And we went for chukar and huns. Usually I'm going to North Dakota or Montana for sharptails and huns. And I decided, wow, there's a ton of hunting pressure in Montana. Let's try something new. And so we tried chukar hunting in Wyoming, which was a challenge in and of itself. And those birds are tough. We worked hard, and it was humbling for the dogs and I. And I can't wait to go back.
and so
the more I do it, the more I think the dog has adjusted to the range. It's really neat to see the versatility of the PRL, yeah, sort of in the woods and then out in the prairie.
Yeah. So I don't know if I'll ever end up hunting something besides grouse, but one of the birds that I always tell everybody that I'd be curious to hunt, because I just think they're a really beautiful bird, is the Huns. So I know you've gone to North Dakota for a few years now in a row, and now you hunt in Wyoming. Do you see any we know how the rough grouse behavior changes from like the East Coast to the West Coast, you know, everybody loves to have that conversation. But do you see any differences in that species of covey bird that you could notice between North Dakota and Wyoming?
Only a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm by no means an expert on Huns and Western hunting, but so when I hunted them, when I hunt the Huns in North Dakota, let's say it's more of an ag related wheat field and on the edge, or a pick canola field, and you just know, hey, this looks like it's going to be Huns, and you kind of key in on Huns. What I noticed in Wyoming, we weren't by any ag. So it's just like the same forever, and you just had no idea, like, oh, is this a Hun spot or not? It was just like low density of Huns versus, I'd say, that egg that you hunt next to holds more birds in general. So you would just like, oh, there's a lot of Huns along this edge. And you just got a feel for where the Huns would be on the edge of a picked wheat field. And they were kind of easy to target. Like, yep, they're going to be here. But when we were in Wyoming, it was just seemed like random. Once in a while, you'd find Huns. And I think it just had to do with that more dispersed food source.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So your dogs, you have your oldest dog right now is a Weimaraner. And was he your first personal bird dog? And you had Amy's before that, or did you have one before him?
Well, Amy's was the first Weimaraner I've ever had, and yeah, she had the Weimaraner, and he was young, I think like one or two when I met Amy.
Oh, okay.
Don't quote me on that, but. So, and she never hunted with them, and she just liked the way they looked. And I remember first meeting her that she had a Weimaraner. I didn't even know what a Weimaraner was. And it's not necessarily something you'd be like, oh, upland bird space, Weimaraner. That's the go-to.
Yeah.
That's not the go-to. Yeah. It's the butt of most jokes is like, that's the most washed up pretty dog that it's good looks kind of ruined everything about it. And so it's got kind of a bad name. And I would say there's definitely a handful of breeders that are fighting that and doing the best they can. And one of the kennels she got that dog from was a reputable, pretty reputable. They didn't hunt a lot, but anyways, he ended up being a really good bird dog. I never really did much. I just took him out and he kind of took to it naturally. And I think that's how I got into it. If he would have been kind of a crummy bird dog, I don't know how to train a bird dog, never had a bird dog. And I think he handled him well and it got me hooked. And I was like, I'm all in. And then I'm like, you know what? Wimes, I'm having good luck with him. Kind of unique. Let's stick with it. My wife loves the breed, the aesthetics, and I think we'll always have a Weimaraner around. And so then I went with I got another one and from a reputable breeder, and you know, things, I was having a lot of luck and things were going well. But I think the more I hunted with them, the more I kind of generalist, versatile breed versus specialist, you know, and just sort of, you know, some of those breed history and how they kind of handle very targeted. I'm only going after upland birds. And so in terms of how they matured, how quickly they matured, how they worked the bird, I think the more I hunted, the more I was like, you know, it's a meat dog. I'm killing birds. I'm getting some action and getting some good dog work. But I just wonder if maybe more of a specialist would be for me. And that's when I started looking around for more of a specialist breed and came to you, which is the ultimate specialist focused rough grouse breeder I think I've ever seen. So it's like, well, this is the dog and this is the guy for me. So, and then of course I came over and saw your dogs and here we are.
Yeah, we had some good time. So you have Elwha. That's your Llewellyn setter that you got from me, and he's a super nice dog. You and him had Black Cloud over your head health wise for the first. First, the little guy, he was like, what was he, 11 weeks old, and the poor guy broke his leg.
You 10 know? Weeks, and he got stepped weeks old. On.
Yeah. So that delayed things a little bit, being an April-born pup. And then you got him out later in the season, and he did all right. And then what did he have his second season? Was that when he got, like, caught with a stick in the groin or something?
No, he had something a hernia. Like a big hernia, which I mean, he sat down.
Oh yeah. On his side, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I remember bringing him home after a hunt. Everything was, life's good. Dog's doing awesome. And Amy's like, what the heck is this big balloon, tennis ball, like bulge out of his side of his crotch. And it's like, so then we had to deal with that. Took a while.
Yeah.
That was year two.
Year two. So anyway, fast forward to now. And this was really the first full healthy year. I mean, you guys have had some great adventures together since you've had them, but I know this is the first full real healthy year that, like, you both were not held up that much by injury at all. And you know, keeping away from that blackberry and buckthorn in the grass woods the best you can, because he I know he thinks he can go through solid objects sometimes.
Yes. Yeah. The tail issue. That was last year. Yeah. That was nasty too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's kept our conversations, busy. That's for sure. But anyway, I had him here last summer, and, he's out of, my Missy and Duncan, pairing that I did twice. That was one of the best pairings I've ever done. And actually just repeated. And hopefully we're going to get you a little brother, to LY here. We'll see, knock on wood. See if that breeding takes and comes along here, in a month and a half or so. But tell us about tell me about LY out west. You know, you sent me some videos and stuff, but I'd like to hear a little bit of your experience with him on some of the species out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess back up quick. It is interesting to have a versatile breed in the house and a specialist in the house. Yeah, you get to really see the difference in how they work the cover, what they're smelling, and it's a poor versatile breed is sorting through every scent in the woods. I was like, I got no time for none of that. It's all about birds. And so it's interesting just to see two breeds both working cover and how differently they do it. So yeah, I'd say he's a quick hunter. He's fast and he can get out to maybe 150 yards out in the prairie. Yeah, if anything, he runs a little hot. It needs to be cool. We get him out there early season and he's just like all out, and tongue's hanging out. It takes a couple of days, but I don't know, versus out west versus in the Midwest when he's rough grouse hunting, I'd say he's just got that. I really love hunting behind him because he's got this intelligence of like open country, stretch our legs, cover every, I mean, just like you describe and how you talk about your dogs, you know, every inch of ground is going to be covered in front of you. And the pace you move is what dictates how well he's really going to do. Because if I'm walking too fast, he's going to miss birds. It's not his fault. It's him trying to stay with me. So I think even out west, I just sort of walk slowly. That's what you've taught me. I've noticed that in the rough grouse woods out there. But yeah, he stretches out probably 150 yards and, you know, he gets that scent and, you know, we sort of play the game of first scent stop, look back, tail wag, a lot of stuff. You can see it out west, which is really cool. It's like that first scent stop, Mike, get up here. It's time to go. Here we are, game on. And, you know, sometimes he gets right on the scent cone. But, you know, even the first year, he kind of would find some scent and work his way in and the bird would go up. And I think, you know, a couple birds, it took him the time to figure out, okay, how much are they going to hold and how do I work it? But I feel like he's a great, the versatility of effective 50 to 60 yard rough grouse cover, which is right where I want him. And then 100 to 150, 200 yards out west. And just watching that setter work the open ground. And I mean, I don't know. It's just a joy to watch. He's just so good at it. It seems like you can take a rough grouse woods. And I've talked to a rough grouse dog. I've talked to folks out west in Wyoming and other places that are looking at dogs. And you can really see it. I mean, you take a good rough grouse dog, you can put them anywhere on any species and they can handle basically. I mean, he got on his chucker, the first chucker he handled just really well. I mean, there was no like, oh, this is what we do. If anything, I think he's like, this is really easy. These birds aren't running. They're not nearly as wary. Again, not all of them that way out west. And we do have our challenges, but I think, you know, generally those birds hold a lot better, are more tolerant, especially early season. And he handles them really well. I mean, I think he really likes the open ground. He really likes to stretch his legs. There's not as much to run into. So I feel a lot better that he's not going to hurt himself. Yeah. It's barbed wire fences and cactus really I got to be careful of. But I think he, you know, that's why I'm drawn to it. He does so well out there, handles things really well. So it's nice to take him out there. And I think he's kind of in his natural element out there.
Yeah. When you're in Wyoming this past season, where you were, was the lay of the land like cliffy at all or just really hilly?
Both. There was definitely cliff stuff. The first couple of days we hunted, it was interesting. Like how are both dogs going to figure out, okay, don't chase those birds off the edge. And there was a couple of times I did not take shots at birds because El was tearing around after he had pointed, the birds went up. And it's like, whew, just sailed right off a 100-foot cliff. I'm not even going to shoot at that because he needs to learn, yeah. Like, they're, you know, put the brakes on. And he's, again, he was pretty savvy. He would, you know, I think he'd get to the edge and he'd check it out. And he kind of knew he's a sensitive little guy. He wants to be careful. As much as he's a hard charger, He doesn't, he respected the steeps. And so it was definitely a blend of both. It was kind of intense to hunt some of the cliffy stuff, because I'm not used to it. And he was, I was just, how is he going to handle it? But the more we did it, the more I felt more and more comfortable with him kind of figuring it out. But, and then some of it's more rolling and some of it's fairly flat. So it's kind of the whole spectrum.
Yeah. I can't remember the name of the state park in Western New York. It's outside of Rochester. I want to say it starts with an L, but basically it's just past the Finger Lakes, and it's a gorge, and it's just, and they got like a walking trail that goes along the edges, and they got big signs everywhere. People's dogs are seems to be going off the edge of this gorge, often and stuff. And I just think about hunting out west in some of those places with the dogs, and I know they adjust, but it can be nail biting for sure.
Yes,
I had an older brother to my doggy Nami that I had put with a gentleman in Texas that hunts chukar in Nevada. He's Greek, and he goes over to hunt chukar on the Greek islands most years. So it was, I think it was the dog's second season. He sent me some video I posted on social media years back. The dog basically like on the sides of these like rock cliffs, pointing chuckers that were like tucked in the ravine, and the wind's blowing so hard that like the dog's ears are blown like over the top of its head and like blowing sideways, and you see, and he gets up there and he's videotaping the dog getting up to that point, going on point. And then you see these chucker like careening down like these vertical drops almost. And I'm like, yeah, that's not for me. But they are in hard terrain sometimes, that is for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's, to be honest, the sharp tail and the Huns in North Dakota, Montana, once you've done it, you learn it, this is how you do it. And then you throw in the cliff stuff and some of that. And that was like the added like excitement was like, okay, this is a lot different than what I'm used to in the flat prairie ground. This is definitely, that's the learning curve it's a unique challenge. That's why I want to go back and keep pursuing it to get better at, figuring that ground out and getting more exposure for the dogs.
Yeah, no, if it was a video game, the cliffs are definitely a higher grade level. mm-hmm. So something else that I had thought to ask you was, I know, and I we won't have to talk long on this at all, just that you probably fit into the minority perhaps with this, with having gotten your gun modifications due to some hearing issues that you've had develop over the last couple of years. And I know you finally were able to get that modification done to a new shotgun. And I know, that comes with some challenges, especially in the grouse woods, I'm sure. You probably deserve an Olympic medal, given the number of grouse that you did harvest with that gun. But why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about, if you do use any type of hearing protection or whatnot, maybe, I'm sure you've been through a few things, so maybe you can have some recommendations. And then two, I guess, in short, the shenanigans you went through to get your the gun that you finally got, to aid in your hearing situation.
Yeah, well, it's been quite a journey, ups and downs for sure. And first off, let me say I'm just jealous of you and your hearing and all the shooting you've done. And you're like, Mike, you hear that flush? I'm like, no, you hear that? No, I'm like, I don't hear these things.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely genetic and just bad luck. I mean, I mean, you shoot a lot. I shot a lot. I just think some folks are more susceptible to hearing loss from shooting. Sure. And I started hunting with a 12 gauge. And I don't think 20 or 12, this sounds surprisingly the same or very similar. It's not quite the same. I never had any hearing issues growing up. In my mid 20s, I start hunting, and then progressively every year I could just notice a slight ringing in my left ear. And I do my hearing test every couple of years. And sure enough, my left ear at the higher frequency, I was just starting to lose more and more of it. And not my right ear, just my left ear. I'm a right-handed shooter. So it was 100% hunting related, and I did not wear any earring protection for 10 plus years. It took a while for it to build to a level where it kept me up at night, bothered me. And I just said, well, a little bit of ringing, people have this, that this is part of hunting. And God forbid you put an earplug in. I mean, you're rough grouse hunting. It's like, how can you ever hunt for that?
So I can't imagine.
So I was slow to go towards the hearing protection. And then I did, I had a cheap plug, non-electronic. And I think it helped a little bit, but I feel like my shooting was just still too much. And it just kept getting worse and worse. And then I eventually bought $600 electronic plug, let's say, and I hunted with that and I hated it. I mean, it was just like this ringing, tingy noise, just nothing replaces natural hearing. And I really struggled with it. So then I bit the bullet and spent $1,600 on these ESP plugs. And they were a lot better, but I still struggle with them because, again, it's just artificial, the nuance of the walking through the brush. But I was like, this is just my lot in life. I gotta wear something. Otherwise, I don't know what else to do. So I wore that plug with the idea that, hey, I'm going to at least not make it worse. But to be honest, I think the fit, and I struggle with the fit of it, a couple shots, it doesn't take much. And I could tell it, there was a little air gap and, you know, some of those shots were still going through. And I think even the sound, the percussiveness of the shot was pushing, my whole ear was impacted. And so I think the plug, it was still getting worse. And I could tell it was like a couple of years ago, I'd lay down at night and it's just like, wow, this has gotten noticeably worse. And so my quality, I quit hunting. Cause I'm like, I can't keep making this worse. What am I going to do? What are my options? And I thought, okay, I'm done hunting and what else to do? I mean, I could wear full blown muffs, but I just wasn't, you know, maybe the Western hunts because it's less sound and more visual. So I got to looking around. Anyways, I pursued the idea of doing a suppressor for my shotgun, and I ended up doing that for my deer rifle too, which that was really loud. And I think that caused some issues. And it's a long process to get approvals for the suppressors. A backlog, whatever the reasons are, there's a path forward. It just takes time, like over a year. And then there's really nobody who makes, there's very few shotgun suppressors out there. And part of it's the lack of demand. I think, you know, Europe, you know, some of those things are further along, but, you know, federal gun laws and the National Firearms Act and sort of the discouraging suppressors versus other countries are seeing that as sort of a noise pollution reduction. And, you know, polarizing issue, gun control. So nothing's really happened on it in terms of making that path a little bit easier, which is unfortunate for folks like me who are just looking to reduce the decibels on shotguns or firearms. And again, the rifle suppressor business is alive and well. There's a lot of options for that, but shotgun, it's like, who wants a shotgun suppressor? That's weird. And so the ones they make are really big and clunky. And it's like, well, that I want to hunt. And they're like, hunt with a shotgun suppressor? Why would you? There was like no market for that I could find. I did find a custom outfit out of Colorado, Phoenix Weaponry, that would custom build shotgun suppressors to a barrel. And it was lighter and this and that. But again, there's no, I mean, I shoot a nice Caesar Guarini over under. Quick, short, lightweight, fancy, nice engraving, gun of a lifetime. And now I'm trading it out for this boat anchor that's super long and clunky and a pump. And so, I mean, that was the path I went, was had this custom suppressor made. And there's not great data on how many decibels of reduction. I mean, there's probably 30 to 35. I haven't tested it, but that's what they thought. So I was looking, what are my options? Plug plus a suppressor. That will get me down into a level that probably might not make it worse. So took a while to get to that point. And this is the first year that the suppressed shotgun was done and ready to go. And it's fairly lightweight. It's kind of, it's definitely unbalanced. And it took some getting used to, and I shot poorly. I added up my numbers. I shot like 15% lower on the number of birds I killed than when I shot with the Caesar Guarini. I mean, it's like low. So, I mean, I'm struggling with swinging the gun, getting up to the birds. I have so much history with the over-under. I'd swing quick, get up to the bird, shoot it. And the muscle memory of swinging a big, long gun through the aspen, dragging it through the woods, one would say, is it even worth it? And some days I even question, like, this is, I just want to go back to the good old days, but those days aren't here and I'm never going to have them. So I got to figure out how to make this work. And so thank God for the good dog work. At least I'm getting good looks. Well, I don't know. I'm getting good looks and I'm missing easy birds, but that's part of grouse hunting. But as the season progressed, I mean, I have a tool and frankly, I'm going to, so I wear, I actually ditched the electronic plug in favor of a really cheap, more of a diaphragm when a loud sound goes. It's supposed to close because it gives me more natural hearing, which, you know, I really miss is to have the natural hearing. So I'm hoping that cheap plug with a diaphragm in it that, you know, when the shot goes off should close and protect a little bit. The suppressor, which when you shoot it, folks will be like, well, that doesn't sound much quieter. But to me, when I hear them shoot their unsuppressed gun, I'm like, well, you have no idea. Let me tell you how loud that is. So I, you know, I, it's helping, but my next step is going to actually pursue subsonic ammo. And I did buy some subsonic ammo because cracking the sound barrier adds that much more sound, but I like to shoot non-lead. So no one really makes, get this, no one makes a non-lead subsonic ammo because really nobody's asking for it. So yeah, right. I'm like, can I get a suppressed shotgun with subsonic non-tox? So they're like, what and what? So I'm trying to, you know, pave this way for me. And that's the path. So I might get into, I'm planning into getting into reloading and figuring out how I can do that. But that's my journey. And the nice thing is I hunt out west with the over-under. That open landscape, the sound is a lot more dissipated. So I actually hunt with like Walker game muffs. And because it's more of a visual thing out there anyways, dogs on point and you visually see the bird go up. So I really look, that's part of the Western trip things too, is I get to carry the nice gun and that means a lot to me, is to carry that nice gun and out and carry it out there. So that's that's where we're at on my evolution and issues with hearing and gunshots, which is a concern for everybody, I think. And, you know, it'd be nice to see more options out there for folks to kind of get ahead of this before it gets too late.
I haven't made the transition to non-toxic shot consistently by any means, for years I had used, before COVID and ammo got ridiculous in price and all these different changes with ammunition, I have not gotten into the reloading aspect of things myself, which I certainly should given the number of times I pull a trigger in a season. But I used RST 2.5-inch, 3/4-ounce loads. And let me tell you, man, I feel like you're shooting a cap gun in my 20-gauge with those. And I use them forever. I mean, I feel like it's like 30%, 40% more quiet than the 2 3/4-inch shells with, you know, 7/8 ounce in there, you know? So
interesting.
I don't know. And I shot super well with those, you know, Falcon Light 2.5-inch 20-gauge shells, you know, 3/4 ounce. I shot terrific with my Satori, with that. The only reason why I stopped and just switched to using Federal, and I use 6-shot 1-ounce, in the grouse woods all season. Now that it's kind of go big or go home, I guess I switched my attitude, but, you know, I had to start paying like a ridiculous amount for shipping for RST to get to me, and it just wasn't. It was twice more than twice the price, you know, for me to buy RST now than in the past. But those 2.5-inch shells, let me tell you that it was unbelievable, the difference all around. You know, so I did use those for a number of years. Maybe that's why I can still hear a grouse from 40 yards away in any weather. But, you know, you should see if you get a hand on a box of those, just to see, assuming the pump can shoot 2.5s. I don't know.
I don't even know. I struggle with that pump too. It's jamming about every other time. So I got to do some off season practice in general, but I do think that's a good point in terms of what is the sound, you know, there's options out there, I think. And I think you're right. That definitely is probably I'm sure it's reducing sound.
Yeah. I mean, I've had hunts where, you know, like I ran out of those shells and then, you know, my buddy's hunting with a 20. So they give me a handful of shells and, you know, whatever the last, you know, 500 times I pulled my trigger, it was with those 2.5-inch, you know, RSTs. And And then I pull the trigger on, you know, 3/4 inch, whatever they got in there. And I'm like, whoa, you know, it's quite the difference. So, well, for you, it might be something to check out.
Yeah. Yeah. During COVID, I was shooting Boss ammo and I could only get 3-inch shells. And I think that really was what put me over the top because I couldn't get anything else. And I pulled the trigger on those 3-inch, you know, heavy loads from Boss. It was like, poof, wow. I'm like, I can't shoot those at all. So that makes sense. You know, you start dropping that down. And
I tried the Boss shells. I tried the Boss shells. I think you could take down an elephant with that stuff. It's pretty, it's pretty serious stuff. I know a lot of people love it and I think they're a great company. But yeah, those are some serious shell power there. So, two more big subjects that I love to cover in this conversation. I think, the first one, I'd like to talk about, you know, your Sharp Tail habitat project that you've been working on for a few years now. Maybe just kind of give some broad strokes in terms of what you've been doing with that, and then when we get into our legislative conversation, we can kind of jump back over to potential impacts on your project.
Yeah, great. No, I'm really excited about it. Northwest Wisconsin historically had sharptail Wisconsin, or sharptail in the Northwest Sands, we call it. And part of Bayfield County, the forest I work on, has sandy ground as part of the historic glacial outwash of Glacial Lake Duluth. And so historically, there was a couple million acres, pre-settlement, indigenous burning, just fire-prone landscape. It stayed open. And as part of that more open landscape, sharptails and other species kind of thrived in that open landscape. And after the cutover and fire suppression and reforestation efforts, the sharptail population really dwindled. And so there's fragmented populations that the state has. There's some state property, federal property, trying to hold on to this historic barrens landscape, which is globally rare because it only occurs on certain soils. And so Wisconsin has these little postage stamps, we'll call them, of state properties that are maintained as barrens. And as part of that, some sharptails exist on it. And we've historically had sharptails on our county forests just through some fuel break, serendipitously from fire protection. We actually had some sharptails hanging on. And as I got more engaged with sharptails and hunting them out west, I'm like, well, geez, we got them here. What can we do at the county forest? And so I plugged in with the Sharptail Grouse Society and the state program or state folks that are working on connecting these isolated fragmented sharptail populations across this Northwest Sands, which is like 4 or 5 counties, to kind of maybe increase the sharptail population and raise awareness to barrens as a unique opportunity, a new unique place that holds a lot of rare species. And sharptails are kind of a flagship of that. If you have sharptails, you have a lot of these other species and people can, you know, versus an insect or a butterfly or a plant, you know, the sharptails kind of helps raise awareness for these unique landscapes. And so I've been a huge advocate as a county forester. Most foresters don't go out of their way to talk about how we can remove trees and provide these other values. But I think there's a unique opportunity to, as a public land owner and the taxpayers, like, hey, this is this a value that the county board values as kind of holding all parts of the pie, you know, parts of the system. And I think barrens and sharptails are part of that. And so Bayfield County has really been progressive in contributing to this, connecting the landscape. We're not going to put everything back in the barrens by any means, but we can strategically connect these properties in a way that the sharptails can fly between these 1200 acre. We're looking at 1200 acre postage stamps of core open areas, burned, maintained, open. That's the size that we feel that the sharptails will survive on. And then if we get them within 3 or 3.2 miles away to the next open patch, you can have population exchange. They won't be isolated. Currently, a lot of these populations are isolated. So genetic inbreeding, susceptibility to weather and climatic events that could wipe out a population. Bayfield County has an opportunity to be part of a broader effort and landscape by creating. So we're actually creating new open barrens, which is really exciting. It's a lot of work. I think part of my job is barrens restoration specialist, which, you know, can't even say it because it doesn't even exist. But it's cool to see the work. I think there's a lot of, the more we explain to the public about it, I think there's a lot of folks are intrigued by it. And we've gotten support at the county. We've got a bunch of grants. We're funding some of the work. And it's just catching on, and the birds are responding. I mean, we've seen we have two Barron's properties. One's been around longer than the other, but you know, a couple of years ago, we had five or six sharptails dancing in the spring, and it just felt like, you know, is this going to work? Are they going to disappear? And we really doubled down on our habitat work and expanded it. And last year I counted, I think it was 13 males on that same lek, plus incidental birds we saw. We figured we had 19 males on like 900 acres. And it was just, I mean, just the reward of seeing this rare, the spring dance from the sharptail is just amazing. And to see it on a county forest, which historically is all about mostly producing fiber, they say. And so we're trying to show that there's other things we do, and that's barrens. So yeah, so it's been a really exciting to be an advocate for sharptails and barrens where it makes sense. And we're part of that larger landscape up here in Northwest Wisconsin.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty cool. You know, you think about, you go out west where they're incredibly abundant, you know, but in your state, they're basically an endangered species, you know, and bringing them back. Who knows what the future will hold long term, you know, for them, if their population continues to grow. But are there any Wisconsin DNR like biologists involved with this, or is it just habitat management on a forestry level right now?
No, there's Wisconsin is extremely fortunate to have a sharptail plan. I mean, Minnesota, Michigan, you know, just in terms of their properties and their birds, we are really fortunate to have a lot of infrastructure and resources dedicated to the effort. So we're actually in the process of finishing up the sharptail plan for Wisconsin, which there's a Northwest SANS coordinator. His name is Bob Hansen, great DNR employee who's in charge of connecting and seeing through this landscape connectivity. And then we have like the Nemecogon Barrens. That's an 8 or 9,000 acre property that the DNR owns and manages for barrens. And then there's Crex Meadows, which is like a 40,000 acre open wetland barrens landscape that's starting to hold a lot more sharptails. And then there's the Douglas County Wildlife Area. And so there's a number of the individual property managers that work on barrens properties. And then there's the Forest Service, the Mukwa Barrens, that's about 15,000 acres. And there's a wildlife biologist that I work with. So there's a lot of interagency conversations happening. There's some private land efforts we're trying to roll out because private land is going to be a part of this. So there's definitely DNR support staff, and there's Forest Service, and then there's county. There's a couple of counties that are like me that are working on what we can do to fill in some of the gaps. So there's definitely a good communication. Yeah. And I've really been trying to bolster that and encourage that, and across wildlife biologists to foresters, how can we all do these things together? So good momentum, good energy. Hopefully it continues. We don't have a hunting season in Wisconsin. We're still trying to figure out what a sustainable population looks like, since these birds are scattered among different properties. So we're working on some of the science to figure out what a small population, what you can harvest from and still maintain, you know, the population. And then, there's a lot of value in dog training and hand trialing on these birds. So, you know, a lot of people do head out west and shoot them and see a lot of them, and the populations are doing well, but there's definitely a lot of value to hunters through just getting some bird work on their dogs and on like a couple of the state properties, which again, that's advocates. People like to see that. People get to spend time getting their dogs on a sharptail in Wisconsin. Pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that's nice. So last week, mutual friend through social media had done a post about some Wisconsin legislation that was going through. He lives in Michigan, and he seems to usually have his pulse, have his finger on the pulse of what's going on legislatively for sportsmen. And I saw you had commented, and then we got kind of into a thread, and then, you know, you called me, and we should have had the record button hit then, because we talked about it for over an hour. And I was like, you know what? We need to have this conversation next week and record it. So I don't know if anything new has happened politically and on a legal level since that conversation last week. I know they were voting on it like that day that we had spoken in the state Congress, I believe, or wherever they're voting on it there. But I guess just to start this subject, why don't you tell our listeners what legislation we're talking about, who brought it about, and what the purpose of why they brought it about.
Yeah, it's so here we are. Let's talk. Where do I start? So there's
you can start anywhere. Users. Start anywhere, yes, Mike. That's
yes,
fine.
Yes. Okay. So there's a lot of users of the forest, and there that ranges all over the spectrum. And part of that user group is folks that own dogs and they want to pursue bear, let's say, or raccoon. And so there's restrictions on property in Wisconsin, state, private, county, national forest, certain times of the year where there's what we call a quiet season to protect ground nesting birds and small deer and the like in the spring when they're trying to reproduce. We want to see these populations do as well as possible. So there's these, like, let's say a May 1st to June 30th quiet period where your dog can't be targeting game of any sort. But there's complexities to this. The southern half of Wisconsin doesn't have that restriction. It's mostly private land. Private landowners do what you want. In the northern half of the state, there's a lot more public land. And so there were some issues in the early 80s of people running their dogs on bear all year. And they were just running all over the place. And I think that's really what the legislation came about, is reining in, like, okay, private property, hounds are running, what's going on? And they set this sort of northern restricted zone on a lot of these public lands, large landowners, and dogs are just kind of run all over. Like, hey, let's give landowners a break this time of year. It's one thing if you're actually hunting them in the fall, but like the rest of the year, you don't need to train them all the time. So I think that was the impetus of a kind of a state line subjective northern part of the state. Southern has more to do with the amount of public land, private interface. So there was inconsistency. So there's folks in the northern half of the state. They're like, well, I want to run my dog on a raccoon on June 15th. I could do it in southern part of Wisconsin. Why can't I do it up here? And so there was a bill introduced to repeal the northern restricted period to be similar to the southern half of the state, which has no restrictions on that other than state property. State DNR properties have restrictions, but other public lands, private lands, you know, why can't we just have, let's be equitable by removing these unnecessary restrictions, is what they wanted. So it's driven by hound hunters in pursuit of fur bearing game. And currently there's a permit to allow that very thing to occur in the northern part of the state. But again, the permit takes a while. It's maybe too restrictive in the scale and scope of what is allowed. The turnaround time isn't long enough. So there were efforts that worked through the Conservation Congress in Wisconsin, citizen resolutions to repeal these protections. And the public voted against it in favor of keeping the restrictions. And so this organization, these folks took another tack, was to go directly to an elected official and say, hey, introduce a bill that says let's repeal this. They weren't making much traction with the citizen advisory method that filters up to the DNR rulemaking process. So they introduced this bill, and the bill was to repeal just all restrictions, which I had some serious heartburn over, because it could be, you could go out and pursue rough grouse and woodcock and sharptail. And here we're spending a lot of time and energy trying to protect sharptails and grow the population. If you could put your hound or your bird dog out there on June 1st, May 15th, while they're dancing and breeding and nesting, like, that's counterproductive to our efforts. We're spending a lot of time and energy trying to protect this population to get them to survive. And sure, if you want to run them in August 15th or September, yeah, they can fly, they're mature, go for it. So I think the concern I had was a bill that was very broadly written for a single individual or a single user group. Rough grouse hunters aren't asking for an open season like this. And sharptail hunters, the folks aren't at woodcock, and the general populace wasn't asking for that. So this bill was introduced. It's very broad. The hope is the governor would not sign it. I hope he doesn't sign it to keep these protections and then find a path, or at least make that permit system more, because I feel like there definitely can be a place for someone who wants to run raccoons on June 15th, but it'd be nice if that person filled out the permit. This is where I'm going to be, versus opening the floodgates to anybody and everybody. And in 5 years or 10 years or 2 years, people go, let's go to the cabin. Let's go run our dog on, hey, you hear that grouse drumming over there? Let's just go see if we can find them. And then just say, where's the state regulations? There's no regulations that you can't do that. Why on earth? Must be okay. And all of a sudden now we're off to the races and that's the new thing. And we don't want to do that. We want to ensure protection of a sensitive period. So I thought the bill was very general for a very specific user group, and why that bill, I tried to, work on an amendment with the elected official, and the bill did pass the Senate, the state Senate. And I hope it doesn't go anywhere, but it raises, I think, a lot of folks, we need to be advocates for these birds and other sensitive species that time of the year. And I feel like you always got to be diligent about what might be kind of rolling back some of those spring protections. And this is one example of that effort to roll back spring protections for all species, all ground nesting animals.
Yeah. And, it's probably better that we're recording it this week and last week while we were still very emotionally charged on the subject. I understand all that and couldn't agree more. I'm sure many of our listeners that are passionate bird hunters, but also view themselves as conservationists, understand and agree. I mean, obviously, there's a tremendous amount of opinion when it comes to the quiet season, around the birds in general, as far as running the dogs on them in July, rather than August or September kind of thing. And while I'm out there hunting hard every day, I mean, I put in 106 days this season, and I hunt over geographically, this year turned out to be almost 100 square mile area. I just feel like I would be totally fine with a quiet season until September 1st, because, for the efforts that I put on them, while you can hunt them. So for me, and us, all the variable age broods that I see, even in the fall between predators and weather patterns, just locally, regionally and stuff like that. While the data might not be collected or there to definitively say certain impacts, I mean, the impact is certainly not going to be more if we're not in the woods, so that much it has to be a fact. But I think that the what we were talking about last week, I mean, certainly in September, between Wisconsin and Michigan, I feel like I cannot get away from the bear hunters with their hounds. I feel wherever I go in the woods, I hear dogs baying. So that's just September in northern Wisconsin and Michigan for sure. I think that while I'm sure there'll be the accidental charge through of hounds over grouse nests and stuff like that, which is absolutely concerning. I'm equally or actually more concerned about, people running their bird dogs, because once it kind of becomes the norm, and it's quote unquote legal, I think, for new people that don't have mentors, and they're just looking at the opportunity to do so, people that, are, again, the law says that July 1st, you can run your dogs on birds and they don't have training birds or pigeons or anything like that. And they're very much in the outdoors and they're an individual, I think that, that opens the door to just, collectively, with the number of bird hunters out there that have dogs that might live within the state or have cabins up in the North Woods. I do think that it opens potential to making our grouse populations potentially, you know, a little more vulnerable, certainly than they are now. And kind of tying us back to what we talked about before this subject, and you mentioned it when you were talking about this legislation, you know, the potential ramifications for endangering the Sharptail project you've been working on for a few years, you know, having any hunting dogs or working dogs running through there during breeding and nesting season certainly could pose more danger, more impact on a species that, like I said, you're still gathering data on as to if, when, or whenever you might be able to actually have a huntable population and open a season.
Yeah, it's interesting. So even within the current regulations on quiet season, state properties are August 1st, the county forest, the national forest, private lands in the northern region is actually July 1st. So just today, I was working with our department and our corporation council to figure out how can Bayfield County become consistent with the adjacent state properties where there's sharptails. Right now, you could don't tell anybody. And again, you just talked about it. Like, if there's no restriction, people are going to say, well, there's no rule against it. We'll go out and chase sharptails on the Barnes Barrens on July 1st because you can. But for some reason, the Nemecagon Barrens has got August 1st. Well, let's all go. You know, they're not necessarily doing that because I don't think most of the folks here are currently just, hey, that seems early, or they don't know about the population yet. But we need to do our due diligence and raise that floor up to August 1st. And in fact, what we've seen with the sharptail comments was that's not enough. Some of these targeted properties for sharptails are getting too much pressure. And those handlers and dog folks are actually asking for more restrictions because they feel like that's too much pressure on August 1st, dawn till dusk, day in, day out. And so the state is trying to figure out, okay, so how do we regulate that and restrict that and manage it and even provide opportunity, but do it in a way where those birds are a little more mature, less pressure, so on and so forth. So here we are with a bill to remove everything. And yet here's another user group saying, put more restrictions on us because we care about making sure these birds survive. So this is welcome to public land management and inconsistency between land bases. But so Bayfield County is starting the process to at least lift our sharptail focused areas up to August 1st to be, and then probably further than that as the state properties start putting further restrictions on their sharptail population. But the broader conversation of rough grouse, woodcock, absolutely. I'd like to see, you know, further and more advocacy, like what you're talking about is like, hey, we need to care about these. We need to talk about these. We need to really look at, letting them mature at a level so they can, survive getting hunted and they have a tough enough time making it to that point. So let's not add more pressure, unnecessary pressure.
Yeah. I think, well, if your governor ends up vetoing it, obviously, concerned bird hunters will, have an opportunity, to figure out some organization, to try to make that bill more balanced for the wildlife. So that's, we had talked last week. I'm all for as long of a quiet series season as can be given. And with those sharptail, again, if the state has not determined that there's a huntable population yet, my attitude is that they should only be able to be ran what would be during hunting season, So that seems kind of logical. Here's an state endangered species. Let's not do that. But yeah, these broad stroke bills, certainly don't come without their negative side effects for sure. So hopefully Wisconsin figures that out and we end up having a little bit more time to, again, have something to counteract that measure that is a little more balanced for everybody. But anything else?
I think we will. I think this bill has introduced definitely some energy into the current code, the current regulations that, instead of reacting to bills like this, which we're kind of doing now, it'd be nice to, there's gaps and inconsistencies. We need to do a better job of talking about this ahead of time before reacting to broad-based bills.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't have my nose in the penal code and the legislative bills that are being cycled across desks, but and it sounds like at least behind the scenes, this was something that was going on for a while, but in terms of just like being thrown in the general public's face, it seemed kind of sudden, you know. Sometimes, you know, you hear everybody, you know, you hear outdoorsmen chattering about stuff that's gonna be coming to the forefront kind of thing, you know, and that didn't seem to necessarily be the case with this. So I can't imagine that if Wisconsin is given more time to assess it, that, I mean, you know, DNR biologists, you know, a bunch of professionals, you know, would, you know, be communicating with elected officials, you know, to try to make things better, or so we hope, you know.
So we hope. Yeah, absolutely. I could go down a rabbit hole with that, but I do think we do. It appeared like it came out of nowhere. I mean, we were aware of it at the Sharptail Grouse Society, but I think in the fractured environment of social media and news and sending stuff out and get, you know, it's hard to get the word out. It seems harder and harder, as much as everyone's connected. You know, how do we make this a priority? How do we organize around it? And how quick is it going to move through? It did move fairly quick. And I think it was, you know, there's 501c3s or not, you know, the Sharptail Grouse, RGS, they don't have lobbyists down there going, hey, we need to talk about this. So we can only do so much from the side as non, you know, we can't lobby for bills. We can only advocate sort of generally. And how much do we engage? How much do we communicate? And the reason for the bill, and that those groups that are well positioned to kind of have these bills written, there's some power dynamics. There's kind of a lack of communication and maybe respect between, you know, some of the wildlife biology versus sort of you know, access and opportunity for some certain user groups. So we got to keep talking about this stuff and paying attention, because these things matter, you know, as much as, you know, the bill may not pass, but it may sit on a shelf waiting for another opportunity to get passed. And so we need to, that's why I tried to make the bill, in my opinion, less bad. So at least if it sat on the shelf collecting dust and it got pulled off, it would be less bad going forward. Why? But anyways, good. Yeah, we need to.
Yeah.
The policy matters. Politics matters. No one really wants to raise their hand. Hey, politics, I love it. But this is where a lot of stuff happens. And so we got to be paying attention and, you know, be an advocate for the species where we see, based on the evidence, you know, it's important. And again, back to more people need to talk about expanding the quiet season to sort of balance out some of the conversation of folks not having the conversation at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully we can get this podcast episode out and about and get a good number of bird hunters hearing this that might not have, and, you know, just get some organization as, you know, everybody becomes more aware that this kind of legislation could be affecting what our birds are doing. Yep. When we're not hunting them, you know. So
yep.
I pretty much covered everything that that I wanted to make sure that we talked about. It was great to have you on, you know. A lot of interesting things to chat with you about. I know that people, if they're interested, I know you're on Instagram, Grouse Wimes. Might have to work on changing that name at some point, Mike. I know, Mike is on Grouse Wimes, that's his handle name on Instagram. Documents some of his upland adventures there. And Mike, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge and expertise with everybody, and bringing to light the legislation that's going on and just things that are on the forefront that Wisconsin's facing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. If I could make a shameless plug for your dog, though, real quick, as a dog owner myself, if you got a few sure. minutes for that, you know, sure. you're active on social media, but I got to say, Well, I really love hunting behind Elwha. I mean, just a fine bird dog. What you're doing with the breeding program and just, tracking true, a lot of people, what does that mean? And what does that look like? And is it better to have one or the other? And how do the birds communicate? Or how are they, when you say hunt to the gun, I listen to you on these podcasts talk about all these things. I'm like, oh, that's exactly what he does. And I just feel like as a grouse dog and the product and what you're producing for grouse dogs, and having different breeds and just sort of the Kyle Warren method with your dogs, just really a joy to hunt behind this setter. He's just so biddable, smart, and just enthusiastic and works his butt off. And he is, I mean, I the looks and the quality of grouse hunting for me with the setter is just really gone through the roof. And it's just, I mean, I got nothing but great things to say about Elwha and his what he does in the grouse woods. It's just a, I mean, I used to sort of run through the woods, shoe leather kills the birds, here we go, lean forward, shooting birds. Now it's like, give the dog time and just watch this guy work because he is good at it. And it's just a joy to be part of the experience watching him work well. And I might be missing birds and I get frustrated with that, but my gosh, I tell you, I walk out of the woods, I'm like, wow, this is just amazing. Just awesome to hunt behind a good grouse dog. And I've hunted a long time and been really impressed with what you're producing. So I'm just shameless plug on your dogs.
I appreciate that. Elwha's a he's a real nice boy, and you've had the opportunity to hunt over most of the dogs that I've had in the last 10 years or so. You've got a good look at them, and most of them are as advertised, as I like to say.
Absolutely. I saw incredible consistency. When I saw your dog's work, I was like, the 6-month-old to the 6-year-old dog, I'm like, wow. They're like, when he talks about first season superstars, I was like, yeah, these dogs are, they fit, pick it up quick and they're good at it.
Yep, they've done right by me, that's for sure. And hopefully, like I said, we're gonna be able to get you an Elwha little brother. Keep your fingers crossed here, and hope that this breeding of these two this veteran breeding pair here, we can get you a little brother and me a little sister, Tanane. That's the hope here. So we'll see what happens. But Mike, stay on the line here after I wrap up this show, and we'll just wrap up on our own too. So everybody, thanks so much for joining us. Our guest today, Mike Mann, he is a forester in Wisconsin and is doing great work over there. He's very knowledgeable in his field, and I'm incredibly lucky to have him and people like him own my dogs. It's what breeders like myself are very grateful for and thankful. So Mike, thanks again for being on the show. Everybody, this is Setter Talk. I'm your host, Kyle Warren. Give your setter a scratch in the head for me. Until next time, have a great night.